welcome in. Your boy Doug Gottlieb here. Thanks so much for downloading and subscribing and rating and telling your friends about the All Ball Podcast. The numbers have been awesome, by the way. Like, we're talking over 100,000 downloads, and we're going to keep, you know, just keep sending tweets to me at Gottlieb Show and making reviews of it. And if you have suggestions, people you want to hear, things you like, things you don't like, look, you're listening to this pod. I'm kind of doing it as we go, trying to figure stuff out. And I really appreciate you listening. This one's a fun one. Fun because I feel like there's people in coaching that I've gotten to know that I really like. And I knew them kind of way back when. And I watched them evolve and I watched them become a head coach. And they've gone up, they've gone down, whatever. And Chris Mooney, I have friends, you know, and I don't know if he downloads the podcast. My boy Darren Height played at Princeton. And that was kind of my first in to the Princeton basketball family. And I'll tell you a quick story, and this is 100% true. It's one of the great stories in the history of my father. So my dad, Bob Gottlieb, passed away, obviously, 5 years ago. I talk about him some in the pod. And Darren was a great student at Modern Day. We played together, I think, since like fourth, fifth grade. And Darren was like a 6'5 Swiss Army knife, could do everything. And he went to Modern Day, and you know, Modern Day, they had just star after star after star after star. So I don't even know if he averaged 6-7 points a game at Modern Day, but he was, I remember Modern Day used to have, you guys remember this on shooting shirts, right? Where they had nicknames, and Darren Height's nickname, I think, was the Man of 1,000 Pivots. I think I'll have to text him to figure out if that's what it was. Anyway, so Darren didn't have, I don't think, scholarship offers coming out of high school, and he wanted to go to the Ivy League and play. He wanted to play at Princeton. Princeton at the time was, them and Penn were the premier teams in the Ivy League. So he didn't get into Princeton on his like early acceptance. Maybe he was waitlisted. So my dad calls Pete Carrillo. He's like, Pete, you got to get out here. You got to see this kid, Darren Height. He's perfect for what you do. So this is the spring. And Pete Carrillo comes and he watches him work out at Modern Day. And he's like, he's okay. So the next day we play in a tournament at Cal State Dominguez Hills. Now keep in mind, this is back in the day when, and maybe this was in the fall, I don't remember. Anyway, I think it was in the spring. But this is back in the day when all the weekend tournaments were at Cal State Dominguez Hills, run by the Pumps. So we have a plan. Pete Carrillo's coming. He's coming to see Darren. Everybody else kind of had a scholarship or wasn't playing for one specific coach. Every play we run, we're going to run for Darren. Because the thing about Darren was like, look, if you've averaged 5 or 6 a game in high school, how do we know you can score? How do we know if you can play? Whereas the argument for Modern Day guys is like, look, if Darren would have gone to any other high school in Orange County, he would have been a featured guy, would have averaged, you know, 15, 18, 20 points a game. He could really play. So we run every play for him. I think he had like 35, 36 points. There's film somewhere available in the first 3 quarters. So he takes himself out of the game. And my dad had the old rule where if you take yourself out, you can put yourself back in. He was tired. He took himself out of the game. So somewhere in the fourth quarter, he tries to check back in. So we run every play for Darren Height in the first half, first 3 quarters. He checks himself out of the game, comes over to the bench, and you know, obviously Pete Carrillo and his staff are watching. He sits down, and early in the fourth quarter, he goes to check himself back into the game. And my dad says, what are you doing? It's like, well, we have a rule where if I take myself out, I can put myself back in the game. And my dad turns to Darren and says, sit down. It's like, why? I'm playing great. Sit down. You're going to Princeton. So sure enough, he got into Princeton. And the rest is kind of history. If you go back and watch the 96 first NCAA tournament win for Princeton with Pete Carrillo, there's a blonde-haired, kind of rather large-nosed, Darren knows he has a big nose, he's a great dude. Anyway, guy waving the towel, that's Darren Height, it's my boy. Anyway, so I kind of got indoctrinated to Princeton basketball there. I played with a Maccabi team with Jesse Rosenfeld, was a center from Princeton. A couple years later, playing in Israel. You know, I knew some of those guys. Well, I started covering Air Force and got to know Chris Mooney, Jeff Bezdelic, not as much Joe Scott. Joe's an interesting cat, man. I thought that thing would have worked when he coached at Princeton because it worked so well when he was at Air Force. Anyway, I find Chris's story fascinating. His mom died when he was just a teenager. His dad was a Greyhound bus driver, and sometimes he would ride with his dad, I think, to Atlantic City and back. We'll get to his story. But from that, a guy who didn't really have a true basketball background, he became like a basketball junkie and ended up becoming a high school coach, then a Division III coach, then an assistant at Air Force, and ultimately the head coach at Air Force, now the head coach at Richmond for a long time, and they have a very good team this year. We'll get to him in a second. Chris Mooney is a good friend, a great guy, awesome accent, and just a really interesting tale of his life, which took us up to this year and this team. But before we get to that, quick thought on the Reggie Jackson trade. And it's interesting, if you're old enough, you're like, Reggie Jackson, you know, the basketball Reggie Jackson. So Reggie Jackson wasn't traded. He was bought out by the Detroit Pistons. He signs with the LA Clippers. And the immediate reaction of a lot of people on social media and even the media is, Clippers got another one that the Lakers wanted. And that's, look, did the Lakers want Darren Collison? Yes. Darren Collison was the guy that they had earmarked to be their starting point guard. He's a very good shooter, a very good defender. He's from LA. And Darren Collison not only retired early, but then they thought he was coming when he didn't come out of retirement right around the trade deadline. And I'm guessing they're still going to have conversations trying to talk him out of retirement. But they didn't want Reggie Jackson. And some of this just comes down to simply he's rep by Aaron Mintz. Aaron Mintz is the agent for Julius Randle. Julius Randle didn't get a contract offer from the Lakers after having a good year. And he's bitter. There's just like a lot of bitterness over the Julius Randle deal. And with that in mind, Rob Pelinka didn't call them, and he didn't call Rob Pelinka. That's not really the case. Now, the other issue with the Clippers, and this is going to be interesting to see, you can only play five guys. And when you have a lot of guys where there's not a lot of differentiation between them, because Reggie Jackson is not a bad player. I think he's a really good player. Now, he struggled to not have his own team when he's in Oklahoma City. He had his own team in Detroit, and obviously, like, this is what a bench guy looks like. Pick whatever great six man you have. Lou Williams, a great six man, or Jamal Crawford. Right? Like the six man of the year, Jamal Crawford. When Jamal Crawford was a starting point guard, his teams weren't great. You put Jamal Crawford in his career as a six man, he was awesome. That's Reggie Jackson. And Detroit gave him a bunch of money, and they never went to the playoffs. Why? Because Reggie Jackson's a great six man or seventh man. He's not a starter. Now he's a little bit older. How does he handle coming off the bench? But more than anything for the Clippers, do they have too many guys, too many egos? And I'll tell you this, that I'm not sure the Lakers don't like him on that team because if he's on the court, Patrick Beverley, Landry Shamet, or Lou Williams aren't on the court, and they don't believe that he's as good a fit for that team as the other three are. The truth is that Reggie Jackson, while a good player, more is not always more. And maybe this is more for the regular season because Patrick Beverley's been nursing the groin and they need another guy and get buckets. But there is this thing about having too many guys who everybody in the NBA wants to play, but at some role level you have to accept your role. To go from go-to guy, starting point guard, to 10 minutes a night, playing only on back-to-back nights, that's going to be hard. And guys all the time say, like, I can do it. We're playing for a championship. Don't care. But it can be very, very difficult when you, truth be told, that's not how you're wired. All these guys think they're better than the other guy, and there's not that much separation between he and Shamet, he and Patrick Beverley, he and Lou Williams. Reggie Jackson's had a lot of success in this league, scoring. Played on good teams, played on playoff teams. So we'll see. I'm not sure it's a total win for the Clippers, although not getting Darren Collison is definitely a loss for the Lakers.
Be sure to catch the live edition of the Doug Gottlieb Show weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific on Fox Sports Radio and the iHeartRadio app.
All right, let's get to our interview of the week as we welcome in the head coach of the Richmond Spiders, Chris Mooney. My guest this week is the head coach of the Richmond Spiders. They've given pretty much everybody, I just like to say, an acrophobia. It's a fun send, you know, because the Richmond Spiders. And I remember, Chris Mooney joins us. I remember when Richmond beat Syracuse in the NCAA tournament when I was a kid, right? Like, I used to follow it. Do you remember Richmond way back then, or was it only when you became coach there that you became aware?
No, I definitely remember the Richmond. As a matter of fact, when Richmond beat Syracuse, I was playing at Princeton, and we were in Syracuse. So we played Friday, and that game was on Thursday. And the player who hit the kind of the clinching free throws, named Eugene Burrows, was somebody I had played on my AAU team for 4 years. So I can remember specifically that game, and always thought highly of Richmond. You know, I was growing up when Coach Tarrant was here, and hoped they recruited me. They were smart enough not to. And but no, I've known about it for a long time.
Yeah, I didn't realize you're that old.
Yeah, I appreciate it, Doug.
I didn't realize you're that old. I thought you were like a couple years older than me. Like that was, I was really okay. So let's go back. When I remember the story. I remember. Okay, so you grew up in Philadelphia, correct?
Yep. Yes.
Where in Philly?
In Northeast Philadelphia.
Okay, so what is there's different sections, obviously, of Philly. What's the reputation of Northeast Philadelphia?
I would say that. It's pretty working class, you know, very blue collar, you know, mostly like a lot of Catholic churches, Catholic schools, Catholic high schools. You know, I would say, you know, South Philly is probably like the most prototypical like Eagles fan. Mm-hmm. And Northeast Philadelphia is probably close to that. Maybe not quite as passionate, but pretty close to that.
Okay. So your dad, if I remember, was a bus driver, right?
Correct. Yeah.
Okay. So, what was your childhood like with him, with your family? Like, give me the sense of, was it Ozzie and Harriet? You know, white picket fence, little house.
Yeah.
Was it a town? What was it like?
Yeah. So I have four brothers and sisters. So I'm the youngest of five. And my dad drove a bus for Greyhound. My mom passed away when I was pretty young.
Yeah, 13.
And I would say. Yeah, 13 years old. Yeah. And we grew up in a row home, which is standard in Northeast Philadelphia. And, you know, tons and tons of neighbors on the block. You know, I probably had, you know, seven or eight kids on the same street as my age. And my brother, who's, you know, 4 years older than me, had seven or eight kids his age, you know. So always plenty of basketball and stickball and football going on the street or at the playground. And so it was a lot of fun, lot of kids, tons and tons of kids, always around, always games going on.
Okay, so how did your dad do it? Your mom gets sick, you're a teenager, and he drove a Greyhound bus. And I don't know how routes work, but I figured like those are, you're gone for like a day or 2 days or even a week. Like if it's a long route, how did that work?
Yeah, that's a great point. So, by that point, you know, again, I was the youngest, so he had been driving for a long time. So the higher your seniority is, you know, the better selection you have of the routes. And so he, for a long time, he had a route to Atlantic City. And so he would probably, you know, he'd be there in the morning. And then, of course, playing basketball, you don't come home right after school. But he probably would leave like around 3, go to work, take a group down to Atlantic City and be back maybe at like midnight or 1 in the morning. And that's the most common route. You know, I think when I was very young, he might have been taking charters and, you know, taking groups a little farther around the country. But for the most part, Philly to Atlantic City, probably about an hour and a half. So that's the one I remember the most that he had. So he was around. I mean, obviously a really tall task and tall order for him, but he was around more than you would necessarily think.
Okay. And then with sports, you know, your mom got sick. It was breast cancer. You know, you're a young teen. Was it really quick? Was it progressive? How did that? And I hate to break up. I mean, the toughest time in your life, but I want to bring up the toughest
time.
Yeah, no.
So actually, she had gotten sick 3 times. So it was like maybe when I was eight. When I was 8, 10, and 12. And then the last time, you know, passed away was actually lung cancer at the end. So she had gotten breast cancer a couple of times when I was younger. And then lung cancer at the end, and she passed away when I was 13.
Mm-hmm. Did you play all sports or just hoop?
No, so I played a lot. I was a pretty good baseball player. You know, speed's not quite as important as baseball. And then, but I really did start playing basketball right about that time. My brother, closest to me in age, was a really good basketball player, you know, very good high school basketball player. And so I just really started to play basketball then. You know, and it was, you know, I would, the playground near our house had lights, and they also hosted like AA meetings, Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. So they would leave the lights on like Thursday night through Sunday night till like 2 a.m. And so, you know, you could be up there all the time. And they did that, I guess, you know, so they have they take a break from the meeting, they go out and these guys shoot around. And so I just ended up being there all the time. And, you know, that was certainly something that, I probably lost myself in, you know, not knowing it at the time.
Yeah. So you, when you're in high school and, you was Archbishop Ryan, right? Was that where you?
Correct.
How good were you guys?
We were, I would just say, pretty good. You know, it's as you know now, the teams that are good, you know, have 7 Division I players, and they have unique names and all that kind of stuff. At the time, we were pretty good. I mean, we won the Northern Division of the Catholic League my senior year, which was, you know, the Southern Division would have been better, where Newman, St. John Newman and Roman Catholic, Cardinal O'Hara in the Southern Division. But we won the Northern Division of the Catholic League, and we were pretty good. I mean, we were by no means, we wouldn't have won slam dunk to the beach or anything like that. But we were a pretty good team of, you know, like 7 seniors, just more traditional, no recruiting, all guys who grew up playing together.
Hmm. So did you get any B's? Like, I always picture, because I remember, you know, one of my best friends is Darren Height, who went to Princeton,
yeah.
And I don't think he got any B's, or maybe he got one, and he didn't initially get into Princeton. You were obviously
right.
heavily recruited. Like, you know, academically, how are you so, like, where did that come from? It's like everybody in your family is a straight-A student? Were you always the bright? Did you get, give me a sense of what it was actually like.
Yeah, so my brother, who was older than I was not a great student, very smart, not a great student. And I don't know, you know, I was a pretty good student. You know, there's a great story that, I found out years later. I was back at my high school about 10 years after graduation. And one of the sisters there said, you know, you must remember our, you know, our secretary, Miss Carey, who was there when you were there. And I really didn't, and said hello and talked to her. Well, the sister told me that I had handed in my application to Princeton, kind of handwritten and, you know, all scratched up and not well taken care of. And that she called Princeton and asked them to send another one, and she typed it up for me without ever telling me. And this isn't like a school of like 50 kids. I mean, there are 3,000 kids in the school. And, you know, that was just an amazing, amazing thing that she would have done for me. Otherwise, I'm pretty sure they would have probably thrown out the one handwritten application, for instance. But I was a pretty good student and you know, probably just more afraid to get in trouble for grades than anything else, and lucky enough to do okay on the SAT. So just more luck than anything.
Okay, fair enough. You can tell me it's luck. What was the peak career recruiting experience like for you?
So I will tell you this. So yeah, so at the time, and so you were probably at the tail end of this. Home visits were really important. So home visits would happen in September, and it was a big deal how many home visits a particular guy had, and so we did all of mine at the school, and I would add, so if I had 8 or 10, and it could be from, you know, it could be all levels or all levels Division I. And I would always ask, my first question would be, what are my weaknesses? You know, and just to try to gauge the sense of honesty of the coach and if he had seen me, that kind of thing. Right. You know, Coach Carroll came in, and he was probably, you know, around the 7th or 8th one. And he came in, and I mean, for 5 minutes, he just criticized. Before we sat down, and he just criticized me and said how slow I was. You know, I came down the same side of the court every time. You know, that I passed up a couple of shots, and but another time I, you know, took a shot that I shouldn't have and just picked out everything from the open gym that he just watched. And I was sold. I mean, I loved it. I thought it was great. I mean, you know, he has a really unique personality. He's brilliant. But he was so honest that it was just, I mean, again, I don't know how much it would work today. But that 5 minutes and 10 criticisms, I was sold. I knew that's where I was going to go.
Yeah, that's how, I feel like that's how they all were, right? Like, I mean, I played for Eddie Sutton. My father's kind of that same generation, obviously, you know, and just where they, that's just how bulk, and that's kind of, it did kind of wire us. I felt in my profession now, it's the hardest thing is that when you are honest as a broadcaster, I think there's a lot of people who haven't played at maybe they played recently where it's not this way anymore. But when you give honest feedback as to how a kid is playing, you know, like, it's a terrible pass. Like, whoa, right. You can't say that. Like, yeah, they're all, they actually understand it's a terrible pass. Like, that's just the language of sport when it's coached by kind of older guys. It's just, it's a really endearing thing. Okay, so you were a junior in high school during the Georgetown game, right?
Yes, exactly.
Okay, yep. Do you remember? I remember where I was. Do you remember where you were when Princeton, like, it felt like led Georgetown all the way up until, like, the last couple minutes?
Yeah, exactly. I can remember, yeah, I was at a friend's house watching the game. The game was in Providence, and I think it was 28-20 at half. And if you remember, they went to the halftime, and it was in the studio. It was like John Saunders and Dick Vitale.
It was ESPN, because ESPN had the first-round games back then.
Yeah, exactly. And they were just dead silent for, like, the first 5 seconds. It was that shocking that this was happening. And further, if you remember, Georgetown had just drilled everyone in the Big East tournament. I think they won the Big East tournament by an average of 30 points a game, and just seemed unbeatable. And at the time, you know, they had that aura anyway. Mm-hmm. Seemed unbeatable. And here, you know, Princeton was up 8 at halftime and, you know, had really great chances to win the game.
You go to Princeton. What was your what's that experience like? You're going from Philly. It's not far to Princeton, but you're going to an Ivy League school. You went to a private Catholic school. What was your first Princeton experience like?
So I went up there and I worked on campus the summer before my freshman year, and so that ended up being really good for me because, you know, I met about 15 or 20 other people who worked in the office that I worked in. It was like the summer camps and conferences. So they don't have summer school at Princeton. So there's a lot of opportunity for, you know, the athletic teams to run their camps and for also, you know, big conferences to come in and use the campus. So I made some friends. As you said, it's only about a 40-minute drive to my house, but was able to make some friends and get used to the, you know, a little bit, get used to the type of people that were there and how the campus was laid out, that kind of stuff. And then I can remember, you know, I'd go down to the gym, and at the time the coaches weren't allowed to work with you, and Coach Carell would be, you know, kind of standing behind like a pillar, yelling at me to tell me to do something that I was down there just shooting. You know, he'd tell me, you know, take a drive to your left, take a drive to your left, and but pretending not to watch. And then when school started, I mean, it was hard. I mean, I was completely overwhelmed academically, completely overwhelmed basketball wise. You know, our practices were really, really, really long. Coach Curl was really demanding. And then I was in school, you know, I thought I was working hard, but I'm sure I wasn't working the right way. And I was struggling. And it was a really difficult adjustment. And that's what I remember about it. You know, our team was terrific. You know, that year we were nationally ranked. We were great, and I played. But it was really tough, really demanding, really a tough season.
No, it's great because, you know, I had the same. I went to Notre Dame. I was a great student. Yep. I went to Notre Dame, and I was, you know, going to start right. And I ended up starting, but I remember preseason practice. Admiral White was kicking my ass. I was homesick. It was cold. I wasn't doing well in school. I go in to see another Philly point guard. I go in to see Fran McCaffrey, and I'm like, I suck. I can't do this. I need to go home. He's like, "What is the matter? You're just a freshman. What is it? Who was your guy who you went and saw? Was it a coach, a player? How did you keep it together?"
Yeah, so it was, again, a little different. You know, Coach Carrill, nobody would have gone down there. Right. Coach Carrill, for sure. And we had a great staff. I mean, it was Billy Carmody, who was later the coach of Princeton, then Northwestern. And we had Armand Hill later was on the staff, who was a great NBA player who played at Princeton. But, yeah, it was more just the guys, really. And the Coach Carrill was so hard and tough. It was really the guys. And we used to do this thing. We would line up before practice, like probably about 3 or 4 days a week. And we termed it going down the line. And Coach Carrill would go through every guy in front of the whole team and just say, really just kind of break down his game and his character flaws and things like this. And so I was starting, but Princeton had there were five starters returning, but Coach Carrill started me over a guy named Matt Henschen, who was a good player, and we were so good, I couldn't do that much damage. So when we would go down the line, he would get to me. And, of course, since I was the one freshman playing, I would get a lot, you know, 10 minutes of it. And then when he would get to Matt Henschen, you know, he would say, "Yo, Matt, just give me another couple days with this guy." And then I would get it again. So it was tough. And the only way through it is, I think, your teammates, you know, because you go in the locker room, you go have dinner, and you start laughing at a bunch of the things that he said that you, in the moment, you're not laughing at. But just to kind of keep the same.
I feel like it, and I don't know if they do this on purpose or if it's just their personality, but they make it so it's like us against them, like coaches against players, and it makes the players closer together. Like, those are still my best friends. I know how close all you Princeton guys are that played for Pete, especially.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm sure the guys that played for Joe Scott, I'm sure they have some stories to tell as well. Sure. But it felt like it was a unifying thing.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I can remember, you know, it was funny because if you Coach Carrill was, you know, 5'6" maybe, you know, and he had all these big, smart guys just scared to death. And then, you know, I would say every single time we had a meal or we're on the bus or we were, you know, making fun of Coach Carrill or impersonating Coach Carrill or saying some of the things he said. And you're right. It became something that it was you against him. It was a fight every single day, but you were together, you know, and I do think there's impossible today, but something pretty wise about that.
That year, you guys led the country in scoring defense. You held teams to like 48.9 points per game. Okay, that's obscene. Now, some of that is pace, right? And there was shot. There was a 45-second shot clock then. Okay, so the shot clock was longer. This is where I'm fascinated by conceptually defensively. Was it like, would you consider it pack line? Like, what was his defensive principles that allowed you guys to be so good as a team?
Yeah. So, yeah. And I believe that year, I think we were like second in the country in field goal percentage defense too. I mean, it wasn't.
He also led the country in, I don't know if you know this, he led the country in field goal, a 3-point percentage offense. Like 45 year before it was 45.2, but it was in the mid 40s. So you guys were ahead of the curve in terms of at least 3-point percentage, maybe not as much volume, but still volume kind of.
Yeah.
And as much as he was, you know, a super old guy, even back then, there were part of a lot of like, look, everybody now is loading up on the ball. And there was a lot of that you guys did back then.
Yeah, no, it's a great point. And I mention this all the time. I mean, Coach Carrill is literally not 10 years ahead of his time. He's about 60 years ahead of his time. And because of the Georgetown game and the UCLA game and these low scores in those games, where every coach would slow down the pace if you saw the talent differential. But if you looked at just how we played, and especially when we played in league and we were still patient but not as deliberate, I mean, you know, having all five guys who can dribble, pass, and shoot, a little bit positionless basketball, you know, dribble handoffs, flare screens, cross-court passes, spacing the court the way they do. Coach Grill is at the beginning, or he's way ahead of the beginning of all of that. And like I said, I think because the games that stick out are the games where it feels like we held the ball, he probably doesn't get quite as much credit. But, yeah, he was way, way ahead of all that. And defensively, too. You know, it's incredible. We started practicing defense maybe 5 days before our first game. And that year, as a matter of fact, my freshman year, we had our first 10 games were away. Away. I mean, I think two tournaments and six true road games. We played UNLV, who was the number one team in the country with Larry Johnson and Stacey Ogden. And, you know, he thought defense was fairly simple. And we were also playing the matchup zone, the beginnings of the matchup zone, which was so unique and different to everybody that it was really hard for teams to score. Our first home game, I remember we played Yale, who was picked maybe second in the league, and I think it was like 65-27, and we held multiple teams to single digits in the first half. I mean, it was really incredible.
So what was it about the matchup zone that was confounding to so many of these coaches?
Well, I would say at the time, most teams ran their zone offense.
Yes. And they would overload. They would just go to one side, exactly, and overload, then go to the other side and overload. And you're like, this is not a great deal. But right. and they would get locked up by a zone.
Yeah, completely. And there was, ball screens were really frowned upon at that time. So very few ball screens. Certainly you wouldn't ball screen a zone, you know, at that time. Teams, you know, and Coach Carrillo used to keep a stat, because people would accuse us of being so deliberate. You know, our defensive possessions were far longer than our offensive possessions. And teams really tried to move us around. But when you start to see that over and over, you can, you know, we were a little bit ahead of them in terms of what we were doing on defense. And so, it was really, really hard for all of our opponents to find a good rhythm. It just didn't really exist against us.
You play in the NCAA tournament. You mentioned you're playing in Syracuse. You played against Nova.
Yeah.
So what was that like for you? A Philadelphia kid, okay, who now all of a sudden you're playing in the NCAA tournament against Villanova. And you guys led at the half, too.
We did, 29-23, I believe. And Chris Walker fell down on a three-point shot right before the end of the half because it was 29-20. And he was great at that stuff. And so we were good. I mean, we were the eighth seed, so we were the home uniform. It was great. I was cheering for Villanova, you know, the week before. They had like a really, you know, they might have been 17-15 or something like that, but a great schedule. And, you know, it was great. I loved Villanova. And it was a good game. I think I had the first basket of the game. It was in the Carrier Dome. Yeah. And they were, you know, it was really, in a way, you know, Princeton played Georgetown. Then they played Arkansas.
Yep.
And then Villanova and Syracuse. And it would have been better for us to play a team out west. Or, you know, it was better to play Arkansas, even though they're more talented than Villanova, say. Because Villanova played that style, too. They were playing games in the 50s and really deliberate on offense and changing defenses, that kind of thing. It would have been better for us to play a wide-open team who had really been shocked by our style. That's my thought.
Yes, yeah. No, I mean, because they wouldn't have seen it, and they wouldn't have... I just think teams that felt like, you know, like the UCLA 96 team. I want to get to that. I want to get to that in a second. And I know you weren't on that team, but it was a monumental achievement, even though that team was a ranked team and a really good team that people act like that UCLA team was a great one. And it was not. It's more finally winning the game considering how many times you've been close.
Yeah. Yep.
How would you describe, so you start 4 years, you score 1,000 points, you guys didn't win the league the last 2 years that you were at Princeton. How would you, if you were going to how would you characterize your college career to somebody who's like, man, I didn't live it. What was it like for you?
Well, in retrospect, great. But at the time, it was tough. I mean, Coach Curl was extremely demanding. I like that and embrace that. But he was really tough. We had great guys on the team, and I was a pretty good player. Like I was a good player to play at Princeton. I could pass. I had a good sense. I was fairly versatile. I was just very slow, which hurts obviously than anything. But we beat North Carolina State twice, and we had we were nationally ranked as an Ivy League team. It was great, and I will tell you this: there's not a day goes by that I'm not influenced by something that happened while playing basketball at Princeton. I was unbelievably lucky to have done it, and it has impacted me more than anything else in my life. And
he called people like light, but he wanted more light bulbs, right? Yeah, would light bulbs light up a whole room? That was his thing. Who was the greatest light, the brightest light bulb that you played with at Princeton?
Kit Miller. So Kit was his last 3 years. Princeton won the title. He's probably Ivy League Player of the Year twice. He was a center, so the whole offense would go through him. I think he's second to Bradley in scoring, and he didn't shoot threes or anything like that. He could score on anybody. You know, he had a great game against Alonzo Mourning. You know, he could score on anybody and was a great passer. He really was incredibly critical to that era of Princeton, which lasted through the UCLA game in the next few years.
So you go to Princeton, everybody thinks you go to Princeton, you get some crazy killer job coming out, right? That's why you go to Ivy League. At what point in time did you like, I want to be a basketball coach?
Yeah, so I wanted to be since I was about 5 years old. Maybe when I was 10, my brother was close to me in age. Kevin was a good player. And our local school, Catholic school, had a great coach named Neil Brazell. And Mr. Brazell was one of the few guys in town who was a white-collar worker. And so he would wear, he had like the Bill Cowher chin. He was about 6'4". Silver hair, and he would wear a three-piece suit, to these little games at this. We didn't even have a gym at the little public school gym, tile floor, and he always made sure that our team had the best uniforms and had warm-ups and didn't let anybody go on the court during halftime and talk to the guys about how they carried themselves. And it just had a huge impact, and I would go home and literally dress in a suit that I had from communion or something and pretend to be him. I mean, he was just like a commanding presence. It was really something unique. And so I always, obviously I wanted to play, but I always pictured if I closed my eyes and picture a coach, that's who I would picture. Just somebody in such command. He just talked about being, having class and he had a huge impact, and I never even got to play with him. His youngest son was a year older than me, and so I never even got to play for him. But he had a huge impact on me.
So you get done at Princeton. How did you became a high school coach? How did that take place?
Yeah. So I interviewed. There was a school called Lansdale Catholic, which is about 20 minutes outside or from where I grew up, 20, 30 minutes. But not in the Philadelphia Catholic League at the time. And, I applied for the job, and they had an athletic director named Frank Giovannese, who was at Bishop Kenrick, actually, when they hired Gino Auriemma. Yeah. And he will tell the story that I was terrible in the first interview. And they had plenty of people in the Lansdale area who were far more qualified. And he invited me back to a second interview, and he said, hey, just wear your sweatsuit and just relax. And I went back, and he had a little committee, and they offered me the job. I mean, it was, at the time, I thought, sure, of course I'm the best person for the job. Looking back, I'm really appreciative that he would take that kind of chance. And was able to get a teaching job at one of the local grade schools and coached there for 3 years. Great place.
So wait, what grade did you teach?
Well, I taught sixth grade for 1 year, and then I moved to the high school the next 2 years and taught freshmen and sophomores.
What subject?
I taught mostly English, or language arts, as it was called in the grade school, and then a little bit of related arts.
What is related arts?
Related arts is a little bit of whatever I wanted it to be, I think.
That's amazing.
You know, I didn't know. So I would do like poetry and music lyrics. It was like maybe the only one semester. You might have taken it like the other semester where you didn't have health and phys ed. But most of my classes were English, which was tough. I mean, you know, it's hard to grade essays with a class, you know, with three or four classes of 30 kids. That's a tough one.
Okay, so you're there for 3 years, and then you coach at Beaver. Now, Beaver's changed names now. So you coach at a school that no longer, I mean, it exists, but it was Beaver College. Now it's Arcadia University. Why did you decide to make that leap?
So I wanted to coach college, and same thing. Arcadia is you know, right outside of Philadelphia, and I really wanted to coach in college. A more traditional route and a better route would be to go be a grad assistant somewhere in Division I and then, you know, try to work your way up through Division I. I just really had a desire to be a head coach. And when the Beaver College job opened, you know, the fair amount of high school coaches in our area were interested, but it wasn't full time. And so, but another job they had open, ironically, was the summer camps and conference services job. And I had done that at Princeton for 5 summers.
Right.
And so they were not offering those as a package deal, but I kind of suggested that I would love to interview for both. And as it turns out, I was able to get both of those. And when I got there, I mean, this is literally my first year at Beaver College. We had 6 players in the team, including a walk-on. That's true. That's not an exaggeration. We had 6 guys on the team, and we'd have to stop warm-ups when the 2 captains would go to the jump circle.
No. About 10 minutes. How much did you make?
As the coach, I think it was $2,000.
And then teaching and all the other stuff, like all in, what were you pulling?
Yeah, okay, so I would say Atlanta Catholic, probably I was making about 26, and then I would say at Beaver College I was making probably about maybe 29, 31, something like that.
How do you live? Like, what do you, I mean, obviously, and this is not that long ago, this is not like the 1930s,
yeah.
This is 97 through 2000.
You know, I think, and Doug, I'm sure you've met 1,000 to 10,000 people like this. Coaches, you know, you're just wired to do that, and everything else is so secondary. You know, I mean, a free pair of shoes and a free pair of sneakers and sweats is kind of all you're looking at, and you're just consumed with coaching and later recruiting and that kind of thing, and you know, developing your philosophy and how you're gonna, you know, for me, how was it gonna be like Coach Carrillo? How is it gonna be different from Coach Carrillo? And that's. I have no idea how everything else worked out, but I know that was how driven I was.
Did you guys run Princeton? I mean, what did you run, chin and elbow? Like, did you run the offense?
Yeah. So I would say similar, not exact though. One thing that I had tried to develop is, you know, the Princeton offense is 4 kind of interchangeable parts around one center. When I was at high school, we were never going to have, you know, our center was going to be another 6'2" guy. And so what we tried to do was make it 5 interchangeable parts. You know, so Princeton, if a guy would cut back door and not get a layup, he would kind of clear out to a corner. So what we did is we changed it. If you cut back door and didn't get it, then now we would post you. And then maybe you'd shoot up to the elbow. So that was the one change. And I had thought of that or considered that knowing I was going to coach high school. So I kind of had, you know, I was probably a little bit too rigid then, but I had that kind of figured out, and that was what And we still do that, as a matter of fact. But that's how I was a little bit different than the exact offense.
And did you run the matchup zone?
So not really. I mostly played man to man. We had a great, at Lansdowne Catholic, we had great defensive teams. And then I think we held teams in under 40 points a game for one season. We had really good, you know, like three football players, some guys who were really, really good at guarding. So we did not. We played man to man. And at Beaver College, as a matter of fact, we pressed. We had a Carlos Sanders who was incredible at stealing the ball. We pressed every possession. So we were a little bit different that way.
Okay, so Beaver College, you know, you're there 2 years. You go 8-17 first year, right? You're two years, right? First year, you had six guys. You go 8-17. Second year, you go. Yeah. You're 16-10. Division III coach. How did Joe Scott call you? Did you call him? How did you come to leave and become? And you'd never been an assistant coach before to go be an assistant at Air Force.
Yeah. So just to show, if this is right before the internet really takes off, and also I was working the Villanova camp, and Joe Scott was interviewing at Air Force, and so I can remember, you know, going to bed one night not knowing what happened, and then the next morning I walked across and got a Philadelphia Inquirer at the Wawa, and he got the job at Air Force. And just my immediate thought was that I was going to go be an assistant at Princeton. You know, I was almost sure of it. You know, as for as many guys who are coaching who played at Princeton at the time, I would have been the only one. You know, guys who either were playing overseas or the younger guys were still in school, whatever it was. And I didn't know that, if, you know, in any way, but I thought, wow, this is... And then I talked to Coach Carmody and was scheduled to go up and talk to him. And then I talked to Joe, and he asked if I was interested, and I went up and sat down and talked with Joe, and in about 10 minutes he said, do you want to come out here with me? And I said, absolutely. You know, Joe and his passion and fire, and, you know, I couldn't wait. And it was unique. I mean, it was a service academy, but in the Mountain West, I mean, it was a really kind of a cool, unique thing.
So you get there, and it's a beautiful place, but it's a different place, right? So, you know, and you'd been at some, and, you know, Beaver's a beautiful campus and so is Princeton, but again, different, like you said.
Yep.
What do you remember about Colorado Springs? First getting there on campus at the academy.
Yeah. So, well, I mean, it was, I would say what stuck out to me was the commitment to football. You know, was impressive and real. And now it's going to be a little bit different than, you know, Oklahoma's commitment to football. But Fisher DeBerry, who is an incredible person and longtime coach, was there. They were very, very good. And just the size of the stadium and the indoor, and they had an indoor practice field and the fields outside, and how many, you know, they recruit a lot of guys because everybody's on scholarship at the academy. And I think that's the thing that stood out to me the most. And then they played this option style. And obviously, I'm sure that's why Joe got the job, to bring, you know, a unique style. And, you know, out west, it's different. There aren't quite as many schools out west as there are back east. And so, you know, if you're Princeton or Richmond and you're playing, you know, in the non-league, if you're playing, you know, Lehigh and Lafayette, and I mean, those schools are, because of the proximity, they're not too far behind good teams, you know what I mean? Like, you know, Lehigh will go down to Georgetown and be tied at the half. I mean, that's unique. And out west, it was just different, more spread out. And so I just thought, you know, if we could, you know, if we were able to buy some games and kind of get rolling, that I thought we could be pretty good, because I thought in the Mountain West there was going to be a coach who was probably in his last year every year, and therefore a coach in his first year every year. And I thought, you know, that's four games that you're going to have a real chance to win. And if you could develop some kind of home court advantage, you know, that's the way I kind of saw how Air Force football did it. Their consistency was worth 2 to 3 wins a year. And, you know, no matter what the talent was at UNLV or Utah or Colorado State, their consistency. And I really thought we could do that in time if we recruited well enough, which was going to be, obviously, like everywhere, it was going to be the hard part.
Yeah, and the league was really good then. People forget Utah was in the league back then.
Yep.
And you guys won 17 games combined the first 2 years, 12-6 your third year, and then the fourth year that's when it hit. It's interesting. My brother was at San Diego State, and he started right about when you started, and he would tell me, he's like, look, it meant not this year, but I'm telling you, Air Force is going to be an NCAA tournament team in 3 or 4 years. And you had this like really interesting collection. I remember Antoine Hood and Nick Welsh. Yep. Nick Welsh was a tremendous player. And then you got that Jacob Birchie kid from Oklahoma who was his dad was a coach, right? What is it like?
Yeah, exactly.
What is that like to cobble guys together? Like, do you just look for military families? Is it academics? Like, how do you find an Air Force kid?
Yeah, super question. So what we did is, a couple things. So you can have 15 official visits at the service academies. You have 12 at the other schools, which may just have changed, but that's what the rule was. So here are a couple stats. We used all 15 official visits for all 5 years I was there. We recruited one guy. We signed one guy who had a Division I scholarship, and that was Birchie. He had a scholarship to Boston U. And I believe for the last 3 years, so when Joe Scott was head coach, myself, then Jeff Bizdelic, I believe all five guys were on the all-conference team, whether all-conference defense, second team, player of the year, whatever it is. And so we really just had to cast a huge net. So there aren't many advantages, but you have two advantages. You're not limited to 13 scholarships, and we have a prep school. Air Force has a prep school. And so we would recruit a team to the prep school and then also recruit two or three freshmen straight in. And we would recruit maybe seven guys to the prep school. And partly they're in the prep school because they couldn't qualify to get into the academy straight in. But recruit seven guys and then maybe two or three walk-on kids. Those would be more the, kids who are more familiar with the military who really wanted to be there. And we made the prep school a gigantic emphasis. They ran our offense, they played our defense. They played a 35 to 40 game schedule against junior colleges and base teams and Navy prep and Army prep.
Yeah.
And that was really a great way for them. It was a kind of a red shirt year. And that was probably the best thing that we did.
So you guys make the NCAA tournament. And Joe is going to go back to Princeton and take over, right? Carmody is getting the Northwestern job. So now it's like, okay, I'm finally going back to Princeton where I thought I was going all along.
Yep.
How did you get the head coaching job?
Yeah, so actually it was John Thompson took the Georgetown job.
Oh, that's right. My bad.
Yep. So and it was interesting, and I followed this more closely than you, but the Georgetown job was open for like 6 weeks, and John was the clear, he had taken Princeton to the NCAA tournament a couple of times. He was the clear person. Obviously, he's John Thompson's son, and it was clear that he was going to do it, but the Thompsons, they're incredibly private, and there were no leaks. There was no hoop scoop. There was no story about who was going to get it. And then finally it happened, and I did think that I would have a really good chance to be the Princeton coach. But I also knew I think Joe really wanted it. And so as soon as that happened, Princeton, who would kind of traditionally take a little bit of time to hire a coach, I think they called Joe right away. And earlier that year, Don DeVoe had retired or announced his retirement at Navy. So here we were having this great year, and the Naval Academy job opened, and I think they were interested in talking to me, and Air Force put it in my contract that I would be the next coach at the Air Force Academy when Joe left. So it was kind of it was done. It was done before Joe even went to Princeton.
Okay. So how much had you changed as a coach from Beaver College to 4 years under Joe Scott?
Great question. Well, I would say a fair amount. Just being an assistant so gives you such a unique perspective and allows you to, more calmly evaluate, decisions and You know, Joe now was, he's incredible. You know, I don't know if too many people who could have taken the Air Force Academy to an at-large team in the NCAA tournament. And he just did an amazing job. And, you know, for Joe, it's all the basketball part of it. I don't mean to say it's all the basketball, but all that surrounds the basketball, the relationship with the guys, the teaching them, the high demands, none of the fluff or anything like that. And so that was great. I would say I had changed just being around, you know, the caliber of player and person at the Air Force Academy. I had probably changed, but I was also still speaking the same language that I had, you know, when I played in college and when I was a high school and Division III coach. So not as much if I had gone to work for Eddie Sutton or, you know, something like that. But certainly had a huge impact on me. And I really feel like I got to know how we could recruit successfully at Air Force and how we could build the team successfully at Air Force.
Okay, so you're there for 1 year. And now,
yeah.
How did the Richmond thing come about?
Yeah, so I was Air Force 1 year, and Jerry Wainwright took the DePaul job. I'm sure, and it was late. It was like in late April, and I'm trying to think why it was late. I forget who was at DePaul. Oh, maybe. I know it was the Virginia job opened late, and Dave Lato went from DePaul to Virginia.
Right.
Yeah, and so Jerry Wainwright, who was at Richmond, but is from Chicago, took the DePaul job. And I can remember thinking, man, I'd love to take the Richmond job. I just wish I had a couple more years. I don't think they're going to hire me with 1 year. And our year at Air Force, I think we had a really good chance to be in the NIT. And, you know, in fact, we finished ahead of UNLV, and Coach Kruger was at UNLV. We finished ahead of UNLV. We had beaten them. We had played a close game there, beaten them handily at the Air Force Academy. I think we were two games ahead of them, and they hosted an NIT game. This was before the NIT was seeded and everything.
All right.
And so I think Air Force, I don't want to say they declined the NIT, but I think they were not, you know, it didn't feel like they were really pushing for us to be in the postseason. And, you know, when I talked to Richmond, it felt like there was tremendous commitment. And, you know, at that stage and how those things work, it was and geographically and who the people were that were here, it was great. So I came in, I interviewed, they offered me the job, and was really fortunate that, you know, it was fortunate that was later in the season. You know, people had already changed jobs, and fortunate we had done well at Air Force, and it was great to be here.
Okay, so you get to Richmond, and mm-hmm. you're used to, now you'd recruited at hard places before, or been, you know, mm-hmm. Air Force is a hard place, and,
yeah.
and Beaver College. Yep. What was it like to, what's it like to recruit to Richmond? Because for people who don't know, Richmond, small school, right? Less than 5,000 students. And a really good, like, is it just a notch below Ivy League? Like, how good a school academically is it?
Yeah, so it is a great school, private school, and really ranked highly. Real unique thing about Richmond is it's a liberal arts college that has a business school, an undergraduate business school, which is pretty unique. So it was, for most people, I would say it was probably really difficult. The recruiting, you know, the admission standards and things. Coming from the Air Force Academy, you know, it seemed like we could get anybody. And we certainly appealed to a lot of people. So it felt like, I had never had scholarships before, because the Air Force Academy is not technically a scholarship. Of course, Beaver College is Division III. So it felt great. And that was the one thing, you know, we only had 7 scholarship players my first year. That was the one thing, like, you had to learn how to utilize the scholarships. Are you going to offer 1 to 3 kids and it's the first guy who takes it? Are you going to save one for the season? Those kinds of things. But yeah, for me, it felt like, you know, we had access to far more players than we did at the academy.
How long did it take to get it? It took you a couple of years to kind of get it going, right?
It did, yeah. And we had come in and some guys who had, you know, gotten in trouble here, you know, whoever had gotten in trouble or decided to leave, they were all guards, and so. you know, we had to play a first year without guards. And then the second year we're here, we started four freshmen, like 20 of the games. And of course, that's going to just be an uphill battle. And then by the third year, I think we finished, we got the bye. We finished fourth in the league. And from there we were good. But it's hard. I mean, you know, people probably don't, you know, a casual fan probably doesn't realize just that there are very few of that it's close to automatic to be good. And even look at North Carolina is having a tough year, you know, unimaginable. But other than those, it's far from automatic. You know what I mean?
Yeah. No. I mean, it's a grind every year. It's even worse now. You know, sometimes you get kids now and they do well, they graduate early and then they leave you. You get a kid, you go to the league. 2011 was, you know, to this point, your dream year where you win the A-10, you win the A-10 tournament, right? You get to the Sweet 16. How different is it coaching in the NCAA tournament from any other coaching you've had? And I know you coached previous year in the NCAA tournament as well.
Yeah. Well, it's just so, you know, it's like the feeling of a big game, if when you played Oklahoma or Kansas at home, and yet, you know, when you get to the arena, it seems like even before anybody's there, when you're a tutoring, there's a buzz, you know, for whatever reason. And the NCAA tournament is like that times 10, you know. The arena is filled long before the first game, and everything about the town, your hotel, there's usually a cluster of hotels and the restaurants. Everything is about the NCAA tournament. You know, a police escort to the game. It's just everything has this buzz feeling. That's probably one of the hardest things is to treat it as a regular game or to treat it your preparation to be normal. I think you see teams kind of trying to get away from all of that as best you can, but I would say that it just feels like your biggest rivalry game times 10.
You've had opportunities to leave in the past, and especially after a 29 win year at Richmond. And some of what you've gone through is the reason that coaches leave, right? You get an extension, but people don't realize how hard it is to get back to that place. If you could do it all over again, would you? Like, is this the same? Would you take the same path that you've taken?
Yeah, that's a great question. I would tell you this. I can easily see advising someone to take the other path. In other words, you know, if you were, if it was your, you know, somebody you were close to that you wanted to advise, you know, the best way to kind of go about this thing, or probably the best way would be, you know, do well, move on, like capitalizing.
Right.
Do well, move on to, you know. And so I can definitely see that argument, and I can see why that would be the better strategy. You know, for me, it was personal at the time. Richmond's been great to me. The people here have been good to me. Maybe it's because of my hero in coaching is Pete Carril, who was at Princeton for 30 years, and you know, I've grew up a Penn State football fan, so. So to me, it was personal, and I loved the things about the school. I embraced the challenges that we have. So I don't know if I would have done it differently necessarily, but I could see, you know, that advice being pretty strong by somebody who knew what was going on.
And, you know, this year's team, you have all your best players are juniors. I mean, theoretically, everybody back next year, and next year you could be what Dayton is. Your greatest recruiting story, I got like 3 minutes, okay? Your greatest recruiting story on this team is who?
Great question. Let me think here.
Is it Gilliard? I don't know.
You know, Gilliard was good. I felt like, Grant Golden is the guy. I feel like every time a team that's not in the Power Five does well, the feature is on that team's best player and why he wasn't recruited higher. You know what I mean?
Right.
And, you know, because people don't realize Obi Toppin wasn't doing that when he was in high school. I mean, he was not that tall. And But Golden, I think, is probably somebody that we've said this to a few guys over the years, like, that you're going to be playing as a junior or senior, and we're going to beat a Power 5 opponent, and the head coach is going to go into the assistant and say, why the hell didn't we recruit Golden? And, you know, now at 6'10", who can pass and dribble and shoot and score inside. And so I think recruiting him, he was probably the most honest recruit with his mom and dad, had the most accurate questions, and was a pleasure to get to know and build a relationship with and recruit. And I believe that is happening now, where everybody would be wondering why they don't have Grant Golden.
At the time of this, okay, and you don't play at Dayton again, you've won four games in a row. You've won seven out of your last nine. Obviously, you lost to Dayton at home and to VCU, which is an incredible rivalry game, before you came back, and Saturday you beat VCU. I mean, that, you want to talk about home court advantage, right? Lose by 20, win by 20. And maybe you guys will probably win again. In order to complete the task, get back to the NCAA tournament, what needs to happen?
Well, you know, we had a six-game stretch where we played without Blake Francis, who's our leading scorer, including the Dayton and VCU games. So, you know, I always say, Doug, I wish the NCAA would send out, hey, if you win 23 games or 24 games, or if your net's this, you know, the only way you can guarantee is to win their conference tournament. The other way is you have to build this best resume possible and play the teams in front of you. And it can be frustrating. I remember in 2011, because these guys are updating their bracketology every day, we had beaten Purdue, who was eighth in the country. But by the time February rolled around, it was like, you know, the Richmond win over Purdue was 2 months ago. Like, right, that was when the game was scheduled, you know? So I think what we have to do is we have to just keep playing well. We have opportunities in front of us, knock them off one at a time, and hopefully that's going to be good enough come selection Sunday.
Last thing, when you stand on that sideline, do you hear Pete Carril in anything you say? Like, are there things you say that you're like, I can't believe I just said that? Because, you know, we do that as parents. We talk, sure, and we become our parents. Do you ever embody your little old basketball coach at Princeton when you're on the sideline?
I do, because my dad wasn't all that different from Coach Carril. You know, he was tough and demanding, and especially with sports. And so I can hear, my assistants hear a lot of that extremely negative. I really try to shield the players from it now. I've gotten better at that. Mm-hmm. But extremely negative things that really have very little to do with what just happened or what mistake just happened.
That's amazing. Well, listen, it's great to see your team doing so well. It's good to catch up. Need to do so in person. In the meantime, congrats on the success. Keep it rolling. And thanks for joining us in the pod.
Hey, Doug. Thanks so much, man.
A reminder, you can hear the Doug Gottlieb Show daily, 3 to 6 Eastern, 12 to 3 Pacific, on Fox Sports Radio and the iHeartRadio app. You can also download that podcast, which pops up daily. Two pods this week. We'll try and keep popping out as many basketball pods in basketball season as possible. Thanks so much for listening, for downloading, for subscribing, for rating and reviewing, and for sending us your tweets on who else you want to hear as we get you ready for the NCAA tournament. In the meantime, keep listening, keep downloading, keep telling your friends, tweet it to them, send it to them on Facebook. I'm Doug Gottlieb, and this is All Ball.